is Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaki on Culture and Race, Part 2. I want to take a brief digression here to talk a little bit about Yaki's quotes from Napoleon. He had two quotes that intrigued me, and I read the last time. The shorter one was, "I recognize only two nations, the Occident and the Orient." And I trace that back to the Latin phrases, Occident and Orient, and their origins in Rome to refer to the two halves of the Roman Empire. But Napoleon obviously had something else in mind. And so I went digging to find out what it was. And I was even more disturbed by his longer quote about if he had had his way, all of Europe would have been like France without any borders, and everyone would have felt at home as part of the same family. So both of these quotes I'll flesh out a little bit here with the help of Eric Voegelin. Eric Voegelin is no friend of ours, no friend of nationalists or racialists. He's a fairly well-known philosopher of history, prominent conservative, died in 1985. The bit that I'll read from was published finally in 1999, collected with some other works. Voegelin was born in Germany, ostensibly a German, but he was opposed to the National Socialists, was there when National Socialists came to power. And one of the descriptions that I found about that period of time is he said that he watched the Austrian and German republics fall in the 1930s when the Nazis gained power. Voegelin loathed the irrationality and racism of Nazism and eventually lost his admiration for Nietzsche, of whom he was very critical in some of his later writings. He also lost faith, or came to distrust, the ecclesiastical establishment, because during the 1930s, all except one of the Christian clergy he knew were Nazis. So his family fled Europe and moved to America. And he wrote in English later in life. Another thing that makes me suspect Voegelin is that Lawrence Oster was a big fan of Eric Voegelin. And a commenter at one point put it pretty aptly, described the two of them both as epic-level falsifiers of reality. That in Voegelin's case, he claimed that some mysterious Gnosticism was responsible for Marxism and other things. That it, certainly in the case of Marxism, is much more appropriate laid at the feet of the Jews. But Voegelin, like Oster, was always looking for something else, somebody else to blame for what the Jews were doing. Now, the context here is Voegelin is actually writing about Auguste Comte, a great French philosopher. And Auguste Comte lived in the wake of the French Revolution. And to put it, his life in a nutshell is hard. In fact, you know, this work that Voegelin did was to try and describe the significance of Comte in his life. And it was a fascinating read about the two halves of Comte's life, but that Voegelin told the story that he told about it. But it's basically Comte was struggling, like other thinkers of his day, in the wake of the revolution, to make sense of what had happened, the destruction of the old order, the destruction of aristocracy, and the replacement of it by this liberty, fraternity, egality, the liberal democratic system that replaced it. And Comte was eventually became the founder of the discipline of sociology and also the doctrine of positivism, what's known as positivism in philosophy. He is sometimes regarded as the first philosopher of science in the modern sense of the term. This is according to Wikipedia, which continues, Comte's social theories culminated in the, quote, religion of humanity, unquote, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's making man himself, humankind, into the religion led directly to what we call today secular humanism. Thomas Huxley described this religion of humanity that Comte created as Catholicism minus Christianity, if you can imagine all of the ritual and accoutrements of Catholicism, including the authority, the structure, the aristocracy or hierarchy is the word I'm looking for, of Catholicism, minus the Christianity, minus the Christ and all of those stories, replacing God with human beings. So on to what Vogelin had to write about Comte, and specifically in talking about Comte, he mentions Napoleon, who of course, was also there during the revolution and in the wake of the revolution. And Vogelin sees the two of them as very similar, Napoleon and Comte, although Comte, he says, didn't see it that way, didn't like Napoleon. But the way in which they were similar is that they both thought these grand thoughts about the Occident, about Europe as a whole, and trying to unify it and trying to lead it. And that's the similarity that Vogelin points out in a section titled Napoleon, Russia, and the Occidental Republic. More specifically, the political program of Comte is related to the ideas of Napoleon. This is a question of which Comte is strictly reticent. Napoleon appears in his work only in order to be condemned as, quote, genie retrograde. I'm probably mangling the French pronunciation of that phrase. It means retrograde engineering. Not quite sure what he's getting at there, but, you know, basically some old dead guy, I guess. Nevertheless, the relation exists. In particular, Comte's conception of the Occident is hardly conceivable before the consolidation of the Occidental idea through Napoleon's struggle with the New Orient, that is, with Russia. So here we get a little bit of an idea, a better idea of what Napoleon was referring to when he said the two nations of Europe are the Occident and the Orient. He saw the Occident as Europe, really what most of us would think of as Europe. And the Orient, he was thinking really of Russia and points east of there. In fact, right here is where Vogelin quotes him. He says, let us pass in review a few utterances of Napoleon. Quote, there are only two nations in the world. The one lives in the Orient, the other occupies the Occident. The English, French, Germans, Italians, and so on are governed by the same civil law, the same mores, the same habits, and almost the same religion. They are all members of one family, and the men who want to start war among them want a civil war, unquote. So that's the full context or fuller context of Napoleon's statement about two nations. And it makes it sound much more reasonable instead of being a purely compass-based or geographically-based distinction. What he's really saying is that, in his mind, the Occident includes all of these peoples, the English, French, Germans, Italians, and so on. And noticing that they have this common culture, that they share these laws and mores and habits and religion. And also speaking against the idea of war amongst them and between them. Something that white nationalists, modern day contemporary white nationalists that would resonate with. So now Voegelin continuing here, the means for abolishing this state of Occidental civil war would be the political unification of the West. Quoting Napoleon again, there will be no peace in Europe except under a sole chief, under an emperor who has kings as his officers and distributes kingdoms to his lieutenants, unquote. The political should be followed by, this is Voegelin again, the political should be followed by the institutional and civilizational unification. Quoting Napoleon again, all the united countries must be like France, and if unite them to the pillars of Hercules, that would be at the Strait of Gibraltar on the southern tip of Spain, the easternmost and southernmost corner of Europe, and to Kamchatka, which is far eastern Russia. It's the peninsula that sticks out into the Pacific Ocean, all the way on the easternmost part of Russia. The laws of France must extend everywhere. So this, I guess, was in the context of him imagining conquering Russia and then uniting this vast territory from Gibraltar to and the western part of the Mediterranean all the way to the Pacific Ocean on the far side of Russia. And he wanted to see the laws of France, this common structure that he had described as holding in the Occident, in the West, extended to the Occident plus the Orient that he foresaw conquering. And then in retrospect, Voegelin writes, this must be after Napoleon was defeated, that he said this, why did my code Napoleon not serve as the basis for code European? And why my university imperial not as the model for a university European? In this manner, we would have formed in Europe one and the same family. Everybody, when traveling, would have found himself at home. That's the second quote that Yaki notes at the beginning of his chapter about culture. Culture and race, what he calls cultural vitalism. The Occident, and this is Voegelin again, the Occident is a unit not only because of its internal history and coherence, it is forced toward a still more intense history and coherence. It is forced toward a more intense unification because of its defensive position against Russia. So it was in opposition to Russia that the Occident was, at least in Voegelin's interpretation of what Napoleon was getting at, made more coherent by that contrast. And that's common, you know, when you identify the outsider, it pulls the insiders together when they circle the wagons around themselves. Continuing here with in the next paragraph of Voegelin, Napoleon elaborates this problem on the occasion of the Russian plans with regard to Turkey. The ideas of the Tsar revolved around the conquest of Turkey. Quote, this is Napoleon now, we discussed several times the possibility and eventuality of its partition and the effect on Europe. At first sight, the proposition attracted me. I considered that the partition would extend the progress of civilization. However, when I considered the consequences more coolly, when I saw the immense power that Russia would gain and the great number of Greeks in the provinces now subject to the Sultan who would join a power which is already colossal, I refused roundly to have a part in it, unquote. The principal difficulty was Russia's design on Constantinople. For Constantinople, c'est l'empire du monde, is the empire of the world. It was obvious that France, and quoting here from Napoleon again, even if she possessed Egypt, Syria, and India, would be nothing in comparison with what these new possessions would make of Russia. The barbarians of the north were already much too powerful. After this partition, they could overrun all Europe. I believe this still, unquote. So this is why Napoleon sought to conquer Russia, although I admit I don't really understand fully what was on his mind in invading Russia. Was he trying to defend Russia from being overrun, or was he just in it to try and make for a grander, greater empire over which he was going to rule? In another mood, he sees this danger present even now, quoting again, "If Russia finds an emperor who is courageous, impetuous, capable, in brief, a czar who has a beard on his chin, then Europe is his. He can begin his operations on the German soil itself at 100 leagues from Berlin and Vienna, whose sovereigns are the only obstacles. He enforces the alliance of the one with his help, and with his help he will defeat the other. From this moment, he is in the heart of Germany," unquote. At this juncture, Napoleon puts himself in the place of the conqueror and continues, quote, "Certainly, if I were in this situation, I would arrive at Calais according to a timetable in moderate marches, and there I would find myself master and arbiter of Europe," unquote. Then in the conversation, the dream of the conquest of the Occident separates from the Russian problem. He is now himself the conqueror who is master and arbiter of Europe, and he addresses his interlocutor, quote, "Perhaps, my friend, you are tempted to ask me, like the minister of Pyrrhus asked his master, and what is all this good for? I answer you, for founding a new society and for the prevention of great disasters. Europe waits for this relieving deed and solicits it. The old system is finished, and the new one is not yet established, and it will not be established without long and violent convulsions," unquote. So Napoleon saw himself at this crux in history between the old regime, the ancien regime, and the new system, which was, it was not even clear what it was going to look like at that point in time. Even in retrospect, we have trouble understanding what happened. This is Vogelin again, "let us finally recall that Napoleon also dreamed of making Paris the seat of the spiritual power of the Occident, as of its temporal power. With the Pope in Paris, the city would have become, quote, the capital of the Christian world, and I would have directed both the religious world and the political. I would have had my religious sessions, like my legislative sessions. My councils would have been the representation of Christianity. The popes would have been only its presidents. I would have opened and closed these assemblies, approved and published their decisions, as it had been done by Constantine and Charlemagne," unquote. And that's the last I want to read of what Vogelin had to say about Napoleon. And a lot of that was Napoleon. That's why it's, I don't feel all that bad about reading Eric Vogelin, whose opinion I otherwise wouldn't trust. He's really just gluing together several comments that Napoleon himself made. And it's interesting to see Napoleon as one of a series of European leaders, from Constantine to Charlemagne to Napoleon to Hitler. And who's next? We wonder, as Europeans, who's coming next? One thing I don't like about this description, and where Vogelin probably is spinning it, is to write the Jews out of the equation, write race out of the telling of the story. And that is what the Occident shares, is its race. Especially in the northwest of Europe, the people are genetically remarkably homogeneous, certainly in comparison to even the peoples of North Africa, the Middle East, and beyond the Urals, and even Eastern Europe. There's an area, especially where he describes Germany, France, Britain, that is remarkably homogeneous, and not just in culture, but that culture arises from the fact that the peoples themselves are very similar to each other. And whether it was Napoleon who sort of glosses over the race, and I don't think it was Napoleon. I think Napoleon probably did see that it was the people themselves that created this common culture to which he referred. It was probably Voegelin who was scrubbing that out, in effect. There was an interesting article at Radix Journal back in January that also mentions this Occident and Orient idea, and specifically the Occident, and with reference to Europe and these ideas that we're reviewing here. The article is introduced and described by its author as a series of three articles. I only found two. He, I guess, never has published the third one yet. How we get from a stato-national feeling to pan-Occidental awareness. So he's dealing with the problem of white nationalism, of how do we unite the nations of Europe so that they see the common cause that they have as a race. And he makes a very good argument that I'll probably dig into in a future podcast or blog post. But he points out that Western European nations actually originated with the Carolingian Empire and the breakup of it, which was shared out in 843 AD between the three grandsons of Charlemagne. From the dislocation of the Western Empire, as it was then named, the Occident, emerged thus three states. These were Francia or Occidentalis, which would become France, and Francia Orientalis, later the Holy Roman Empire, which was Germanic. Now here's yet another meaning of the word Oriental, or Orientalis, is to mean Germany, not Russia, not the Middle East, not the Far East, but from the beginnings of Europe, it was actually, and this is after the Roman Empire had already fallen apart, the Western Empire was the western half of the former Roman Empire, essentially, and parts north. And then there was a third section. Lothair kept an awkwardly shaped strip in the middle, including all of the regions European powers would seek to conquer up to World War II, what would later become the Low Countries, Rhineland, Alsace, Switzerland, and Northern Italy. The Wikipedia has a page for what they call East Francia, which is Francia Orientalis. And you can see on the map that it's most of what eventually became Germany, and also Austria and Croatia. Now, someone signing as Marcus left a comment on my last program post, part one of this series about culture and race, and he referred to an article that he had written that he had titled Napoleon, Visionary Racial Nationalist. And he mentioned a quote of Napoleon's that he had run into that makes what he says is the right case for ethno-nationalism, in contrast to what many white nationalists of today do when they look for moral or scientific justifications for their ideology. And he bolds the particular section where he's talking about what happened in Saint-Domingue, what became the Dominican Republic in Haiti, where the during the revolution the blacks killed all the whites. And Napoleon is quoted as saying, "I am for the whites because I am white. I have no other reason, and that one is good. How is it possible that liberty was given to Africans, to men who has no civilization, who did not even know what the colony was, what France was? It is perfectly clear that those who wanted the freedom of the blacks wanted the slavery of the whites." Well, this is a moral justification. I think Marcus doesn't quite understand morality in the same way that I do. I agree with him that we don't need to look into science and base our arguments on IQ or scientific facts or anything like that. It is more about identity. It's about our common interests. And that is a moral justification. It's a morality that's based on a particularist, group-centric understanding of what's right and what's wrong. Is it right or wrong for us? And who is us? That is morality. Napoleon's claim that it is perfectly clear that those who wanted the freedom of the blacks wanted the slavery of the whites is interesting in light of his regard for the Jews. It's not difficult to find. Anyone who types Napoleon and Jews into a search engine can find it on Wikipedia even. And in that pro-Jewish environment, the article Napoleon and the Jews paints a mixed picture of Napoleon's attitude toward the Jews. On the one side, he's described as enacting laws that emancipated European Jews from the old laws restricting them to ghettos, as well as the many laws that limited Jews' rights to property, worship, and careers. The net effect of his policies as a result significantly changed the position of the Jews in Europe, and he was widely admired by the Jews as a result. Starting in 1806, Napoleon passed a number of measures supporting the position of the Jews in the French Empire. Later on in the article, it says, Napoleon's indirect influence on the fate of the Jews was even more powerful than any of the decrees recorded in his name. By breaking up the feudal trammels of mid-Europe and introducing the equality of the French Revolution, he effected more for Jewish emancipation than had been accomplished during the three preceding centuries. So the Jews credit Napoleon with delivering them, emancipating them, freeing them from the restrictions that they had previously been subject to in most of Europe. And some of those restrictions were later reimposed when Napoleon was defeated and the indigenous peoples of those parts of Europe reasserted themselves and their own authority. The interesting thing, though, is that this article itself is schizophrenic. It presents at the same time some statements that Napoleon made in private letters, and so probably come closer to reflecting his true understanding and his true desires. In one letter, he wrote, "It is necessary to reduce, if not destroy, the tendency of Jewish people to practice a very great number of activities that are harmful to civilization and to public order in society in all the countries of the world. It is necessary to stop the harm by preventing it. To prevent it, it is necessary to change the Jews. Once part of their youth will take its place in our armies, they will cease to have Jewish interests and sentiments. Their interests and sentiments will be French." Later in another letter, the first letter was in 1806. This one is from 1808. "I have undertaken," this was to his brother Jerome, "I have undertaken to reform the Jews, but I have not endeavored to draw more of them into my realm. Far from that, I have avoided doing anything which could show any esteem for the most despicable of mankind." My reading of this is that Napoleon somewhat understood the Jews as this most despicable of mankind and as the source of their power being usury, finance, and that they were a threat, that they were causing great harm. But he underestimated them. He thought he could assimilate them. He thought it would be as simple as emancipating them and having them join his own military. The old aphorism, having the fox guard the hen house, comes to mind in this case. Could Napoleon have been such a fool? Whether he was or not, and whether that was the reason why he helped to emancipate the Jews, the results were disastrous for European men.